We are very excited to tell you that we have a live event coming up to support our book about Beverly Hills 90210, titled A Very Special 90210 Book. McNally Jackson, a fantastic independent bookstore in New York City, will be hosting a virtual event on Zoom. Sarah and I will chat a little bit about the show and the book, and then we'll host a round of 90210 trivia in which you can participate. There will even be prizes. This is all going to be happening Friday, September 25th, starting at 7 p.m. Eastern. There's no charge, but you do have to go RSVP. So for more information, go to againwiththis90210.com/trivia. Once again, that's Friday, September 25th, starting at 7 p.m. Eastern. RSVP at againwiththis90210.com/trivia. Thank you so much. We will literally see you there.
Hey, you kind of snuck up on us there.
Hello, everybody. This is Again With This, Melrose Place. Today's episode is Season 2, Episode 24, Love Mancini Style, and not as I originally read it, Love Macaroni Style. And now here are your hosts, Tara Ariano and Sarah D. Budding.
Hello, Sarah.
Hello.
Big news.
Guys, our commitment to this bit about writing a book is so strong that we actually wrote it, and it's coming out tomorrow.
It's true.
And everyone is very excited, and we do mean everyone. Clip, please.
Please play clip two, Dave.
Bam! What's happening? What's happening? Sarah, it's Ian. Tara, it's Ian. I don't think I have to say that. I know you guys are huge, huge fans of 90210. So much so that somebody's got a book coming out very soon. Congratulations on that. When's it coming out? Like the 22nd of September? Man, dedicated. I really appreciate that. You guys are on fire. It's so nice to have been part of a project that touches people in such a positive way, so much so that it has inspired others like you two to create podcasts and write books. And I don't know. I'm wondering if any of us on the show are worthy of all this adulation. It was really just a job, but turned out to be something so much more. And I certainly appreciate that. I wish you all the best in continuing the success that you have gotten, and even more so moving into the future. I know this has been a tough year for us all, but for you guys, I hope it's your best year yet. Take care.
Ian, New Jersey's own. Sigh. I love that he's like, yeah, it was just a job. Now Sharknado. Whatever. Anyway, it turns out that while the book, when you get it, dear listener, will contain our entries on the 93 most important episodes of the show, we actually wrote 100. And just for you, we're going to be dropping these 7 very special deleted entries on our regular podcast feed, that's this one, every Thursday starting this week, September 24th, read by the authors and commented upon by both of us. Possibly all 3 of us if Dave has anything to add or remembers the episode in question at all.
I'm just happy we're keeping Mr. Ziering in griddle cakes.
Indeed.
Yeah. Look, it is important. And it is our gift to you to thank you for supporting this podcast and making the book possible. But speaking of the book, please buy the book. The link is in the show notes, and we think you will really love it. After living with it, lo, these 2 years, we still love it, actually. So please buy it in whatever format from your local bookseller or whomever.
Indeed. 2 other announcements. We are experiencing thunder here in Austin, so if you have heard strange noises that sound like nature, that is in fact what it is. Also, again with this episode 19 will not be dropping until October 9th. Normally, of course, as you know, if you are a supporter of us on Patreon, and we thank you if you are, you know that it's every other week. But this October has five friggin' Fridays, and right now our Patreon supporters still have us under that threshold of support where we would regularly be doing three bonus episodes of every month. If you want that to change, go to patreon.com/againwiththis, get us up over that threshold, and then we will be doing even more bonus episodes for thee. So topic for October 9th is TBD, but there will be one coming on that date very, very soon. Sarah D. Bunting, shall we get into this episode of Melrose Place?
Yes.
All right. Let us begin with our C-plot again. Very much earning the grade. Prenuptial celibacy stuff.
Ugh.
Billy is in the pool, letting half to two-thirds of the audience objectify him. I am among them. When Jake comes down from Amanda's place, Billy tries to make the first move in healing their relationship, saying he and Allison were talking about their feud or whatever it is. But Jake shrugs that not everyone has to be best friends. And he leaves, and Allison advises Billy to give him time. For now, they have a wedding to plan. And Billy vaguely says he's fine with all of it, meaning whatever she chose to do. And she starts, of course, whining that they haven't made any decisions, starting with a church, but he doesn't care where they do it, and hand waves that she'll pick a place, and whatever she finds, he will love it. And when we pick back up with this fucking Borathon, Allison is telling Jane it's good that white doesn't have to mean virgin anymore as she looks through gown sketches. And I don't know what is with the timeline of this episode, because while we do shit out of order for the podcast, Allison is wearing an outfit that in the chronology of the episode, we saw her wear at least one and possibly as many as 2 days earlier. But anyway, Jane asks what Billy's wedding gown preferences are, and Allison says he has no opinions about any of it, and then goes on to complain about the timeline of their relationship having made it so that now they're on the verge of marriage and there's no mystery left between them. She wants to go traditional. She's only going to have one wedding in her life. We'll see. And it has to be the one she always dreamed of. And now she has to wake Billy from his unromantic slumber. But it's not going to happen the next night when she comes home with two handleless paper bags of groceries and Billy barely acknowledges her, never mind getting up from the couch to help her with them. She snaps the TV off and tells him they need to talk about leaving all the wedding planning to her. And he shrugs that she's better at it than he is. And she shrieks that she doesn't know any more about planning a wedding than he does. She's scared that he's already given up. Clip three.
This isn't supposed to be miserable.
Oh, God.
Miserable is where you get your mail, Eeyore.
Oh,
shut
God.
Up. If you don't want it to be miserable, go to City Hall.
Like, everything in your life is miserable. Like, that's where your starting point is.
Yeah.
Like, take it down 10 notches with the tone for starters. Anyway.
Yeah. Also, he isn't miserable because he's like, whatever you want.
Exactly.
Just do whatever you want then. It's not that hard.
Yeah. This is, by the way, how I planned my wedding because I was not in the country while it was being planned. And my mother just did whatever, and I didn't care. Anyway, she goes on. This is supposed to be fun and romantic, and they haven't done one romantic thing since they got engaged. And he says he'll try to be more attentive, starting immediately, and, like, comes at her without even asking whether there's ice cream in the grocery bags that they need to put away first, by the way.
I was thinking it.
Thank you. See, this is why our marriage works.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's when she drops the bomb. Clip four.
Oh, there's one more thing. I've decided we shouldn't have sex until after the wedding. Our wedding night will be the next time we make love.
That's weeks, months from now.
It'll add to the excitement.
It's gonna make me irritable.
No, it'll make you attentive, and it'll make the whole wedding more romantic.
Have we already discussed that there's no way Allison does anything else but lie there? Because I'm pretty sure that's the extent of her moves. Like, how much is he missing?
I was about to make the
really?
Point, like, oh, you could still do oral. And then it's like, there's absolutely no way she gives a beach. And if she does, it's fucking horrible.
She just
gotta
shrieks
form a
at
seal,
it.
Honey. What? you know, for kids. Buy our book.
I mean, there is dirty stuff in the book. It's true.
There sure is. The number of times I'm like, hey, David, try putting it in her butt. 3 times. That's how many.
Moving on to our B plot. Speaking of butts. It's not speaking of butts. This has nothing to do with butts. Joe tries to close the book on Reed in the corniest possible way. So as we open, Joe is in labor under a very fake pregnancy pad. You can definitely see in the visual aids.
Oh, God. It's so bad. It's seriously a PA crumpled up a sweatshirt. You can see a sleeve outline. It's so bad.
It's true. She's being sped through a hospital as, hey, it's that Mary Pat Green, see her in the visual aids too, encourages her to focus on her breathing. Joe starts screaming as they bring her into a delivery room, and then fucking Reed is between her legs. Sarah, please describe the tableau that we see, which is also, of course, in the visual aids. But for those who do not click through and make the mistake of not seeing this with their own two eyes, please describe.
Okay, well, the stunt baby, I mean, it does appear to be an actual baby and not Rex the motorized wonder preemie from ER.
Yes.
But perhaps the reason Reed is glowering in his usual constipated fashion is because he has gotten a hernia because he's not lifting this obviously 10-month-old child with his legs. And the umbilical cord looks like a fucking macrame lanyard someone made at camp.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
Yeah, you know on Grey's Anatomy when someone had to cut the LVAD cord and it was a whole thing? That's what this umbilical cord looks like. It's like so big. It's the baby is like on its way to soccer practice. varsity soccer practice. It's
driving to soccer practice.
Yeah. It's on the way to Manchester United soccer practice. Anyway, oh it's a big God, baby is amazing. The point.
It's big is what we're trying to say.
It's a large, large baby. He tells Joe it's a boy because, of course, this is a nightmare, literally a nightmare she is having, and she wakes up from it gasping. So then Allison's in the courtyard when she sees Joe carefully picking her way down the stairs from her place, putting her hand against the wall instead of on the railing because they're stairs. Allison asks if Joe's okay, commenting that she looks a little gray, and Joe just says she didn't get a lot of sleep and that she'll see Allison at the studio. And then we're at a police auction where Jake watches as the pretty lady is sold for $95,000. So Reed definitely did just steal this boat from someone and or murder the owner. We're just never going to talk about it.
Yeah.
Okay. Like, okay, right? Like, this is what happened, right?
I guess.
Okay. I mean, I know I brought
this
up. Or he,
like, stole his own boat back from police custody. Like, I don't...
Oh, right.
I feel like we never got any clarity on whether he really did get, like, you know, I assume that he did not get framed for whatever he did to go to the clink.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, I think the boat was probably still government property. Like, we have no idea. It wasn't registered, so we don't know.
Right.
And it doesn't seem like I don't know shit about boats, unlike Amanda. I consistently do not know shit about boats in every episode, so.
Mm-hmm. Right. But yeah, there were, yes, okay. It's very mysterious. Anyway, now it's over because someone buys it. And on the way out, Jake asks this guy what he's going to do with it. And since the guy is a salvage operator, he's going to sell it for parts. He can make $5,000 or $10,000 doing that. And Jake says he has a way the guy could make 5 times that much. And at the studio, Joe is prepping a group of models for a shoot while Allison and the client, who, again, with the Seinfeld guest stars, it's Brian George, a.k.a. Babu Bot from Seinfeld. Joe is already not giving the models much direction, these three guys in tuxedos. The one guy on the right in the frame is just, like, glowering at her. So maybe he's used to photographers being more hands-on. When all of a sudden she sees Reed in the frame with his gray dead person makeup on, and then she gets spooked and takes off to hide. And Allison cheerily tells everyone to take 10 and goes to ask Joe what's going on. And Joe's amazed that Amanda hasn't already told the whole building.
That she's pregnant and decided to keep it and is now having nightmares, both sleeping and now awake, of Reed. And this is also where we see a nice close-up shot of Allison's incredibly ugly jacket, which is pieced and has an embellished, like, embroidered beaded collar. And I swear to God, we've seen Elaine in the same thing, except hers was black, maybe, and, like, therefore, you know, more attractive. But this peach number, they just don't know how to dress. This very attractive woman, it's kind of cruel.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that it's like everyone else sort of has a thing that, you know, like Jane's is boho and Sydney's is grungy and whatever else. And like what's left for Allison is like back page sale shit from Spiegel.
Yeah.
That's all beige. Like, that's the problem.
Yeah.
Is that they just put her in these like earth tones that are, I mean, partly it's the times and partly it's that it matches her personality a little too well. But this particular like Jackie Taylor bedazzling is really weird and fugly.
Yeah, it's not good. So Allison says she went through the same thing with Keith when Keith killed himself until she faced it. She couldn't go on with her life. And Joe has to do the same thing with Reed. Joe knows, but it's more difficult when you're the one who pulled the trigger. And by the way, while this is going on, they're just like behind some makeup mirrors. So it would be so funny if this were a different kind of show and like the camera just cut to the other side where everyone else is still there. And like, what the fuck? Anyway.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen.
I just assumed all the Tux guys were like, like with a glass up to the other side.
That doesn't happen because it's this show. But yeah, we have to make our own fun. So, later, Amanda confronts Jake about the Pretty Lady police auction, having found flyers in his pockets. By the way, the police auction for the Pretty Lady, the boat, not a police auction of pretty ladies. To be clear.
Although, yeah, well, defund the police. That's why.
She sarcastically asks if he knows how long it'll take him to get the blood out of the wood, and he just as sarcastically asks how he would ever possibly afford to buy that or any boat himself. And explains he's trying to make a deal with the new owner to charter it. She asks if he doesn't think it's a little ill-timed or inappropriate, and maybe he should go out and get a real job like most other people in the country have done. And he does not care for that advice and stomps out, but she follows in clip 5.
Things get a little uncomfortable and I'm left with your backside.
Well, I thought you liked my backside.
Oh, great. Now make a joke about it.
Look, Amanda, once in the heat of battle, you called me a grease monkey and a gold digger. I'm neither one of those things. And you may want to keep me in denim and work shirts and down on my luck because it keeps you in charge. But you better know that I got ambitions, same as yours, and I'm going to make something out of my life.
Okay, this whole subplot is completely out of character for him.
Yeah.
He would never do anything like this.
No.
It's like pointless chum throwing, and I don't like it.
Yeah, it's like they... I mean, I feel like it's already been so, it's been too many days or weeks since everything imploded with Reed's scheme for him to not, even as far as we have seen, be looking for any other kind of work.
Yeah.
And for this to be what he decides to do instead is, you're right, it's crazy. Like, it I just mean, it makes no like, sense.
Yeah, he would never do this to Joe. He and also like the problem with the business plan mostly was Reed, but like subtracting Reed doesn't mean that you who know nothing about boats should like work on that same boat.
Yeah. The issue is not it's not the issue with this plan is not that he doesn't know about boats like he knows about the engines. The issue is, does Jake know about hospitality? Because I don't see him ingratiating himself to swells on a boat. Like, that doesn't seem like it's in his skill set.
No.
Anyway, Joe walks in on the end of this fight, Amanda bitching about Jake's stubbornness, which Joe agrees he is. And then Amanda decides to try to get Joe on her side in clip 6.
Did you hear the latest? He dug up the Pretty Lady. He's got some crazy plan to charter it. Did you hear what I said, Joe? Reed's boat.
Well, I don't care, Amanda. It's none of my business.
Okay.
Also, nice dog in the background of both of those clips. I mean, sometimes you just have a barky dog and they won't shut the fuck up, but it's like, I have PTSD. I keep thinking it's my dog.
So, not sure it's the next day since Joe's in the same outfit, but then this happens after nighttime in the A-plot. But anyway, Joe goes to the marina to look at the pretty lady and have flashbacks about shooting Reed on it. And Jake, also in the same outfit as before, finds her there, which is convenient for her because she has some yelling at him to do. Clip 7.
Are you all right?
No. No, I'm not. Actually, I'm really pissed at you.
Yeah, join the club.
I mean, you're keeping this boat my life at a really bad time, you know? God, you had to know that any reminder of Reed is gonna hurt.
That's not what I intended at all.
You didn't think it would affect me?
It was a business deal, nothing more. I wasn't even gonna tell you. I'm sorry. You're right. I wasn't thinking.
Look, normally it wouldn't matter, but I'm having these troubles, you know, and I thought that when I accepted this pregnancy to keep Reed's child, that it would help, but it's not. It's doing just the opposite. I'm haunted by it, Jake.
Hey, I don't know, but maybe trying to forget is the mistake.
And how else do I go on unless I forget?
Still, isn't keeping the child always going to be a reminder?
That's the one thing I can't get past, you know? What do I tell my child? How do you tell a child that you killed his father?
Singing telegram?
You don't.
Oh.
You let the network, you make the network let you terminate the pregnancy because come on.
Uh-huh.
Sorry.
Yeah, or, you know, if you decide that you can't terminate it, then you place it for a closed adoption and then it's not anyone's problem because mm-hmm. then the child never needs to know necessarily. Yeah. Anyway, this is just more dumb. And like her backing down this quickly, like even if he does end up chartering this and this is his job, like sure, she never has to get on the boat. But still, like you're going to work every day on the crime scene where I killed my child's father. Cool.
And then the way
cool decision,
she's
buddy.
Like, usually I wouldn't care. It's just a little awkward. Like.
Yeah.
What?
This has not been thought through.
Yeah, no.
At all. So Allison comes by Joe's after work to find Joe breathlessly manic after her talk with Jake. She's decided she can't lie to her child about Reed when it grows up, but she doesn't even know where Reed is buried. What? So they go to a government office that is somehow open at night so that Arvid from head of the class can confirm that Reed is buried in a pauper's grave. And to get Reed's personal effects, Allison lies that Joe is his sister. Arvid will need to see her ID. Joe testily says they have different last names because Joe is her married name, which it actually is. And like, I don't think your driver's license is enough to get this, but okay. And all they have on site is an envelope, but there's a storage locker in Lompoc. And while Arvid is getting the address, Allison picks up a key that he left. Not sure. Anyway, whatever. It doesn't matter. Who cares? Jake finds Joe sitting with her feet in the pool. Tells her he made the deal. He hasn't signed the final papers, and he won't until she tells him that it's okay. And she asks, rhetorically, when she's ever stood in the way of one of his dreams. And then Amanda, in her place, opens the window and eavesdrops as Jake says that Joe has been nothing but generous with him. He thinks she's incredibly strong. She disagrees, but thanks him anyway. And Amanda watches them hug and sidles back inside. And then Jake knocks on her door to tell her the good news and show her the champagne that he bought. And Amanda spits, she's sure Joe was thrilled, and then slams the door in his face. And the next day, Jake goes stomping into D&D to confront Amanda while she's leading a meeting in the bullpen. And when she makes it clear she's not doing this in her workplace, but will talk to him that night and starts to walk away from him, he sits on someone's desk, like just someone who's not there, in the middle of the bullpen and does this. Clip 8.
Hey!
Look who's walking away now.
I was hoping you would.
Not likely.
Jake, I'm not kidding.
Neither am I. I'm sick of this and what it's turned into, some little kid's game about who's angry at who now. We got something together.
Leave now.
So what is it? Your successes matter and mine don't? Excuse me.
You can sleep with an old boyfriend. I can't even talk with an old girlfriend without getting the door slammed in my face. I am not going to be your boy toy, Amanda. Either share some of yourself with me or you cut me loose.
My office now.
No. Okay. Someone call security now. He's being a Brandon. It's unacceptable.
Yeah. Maybe, Jake, if you did get a job, you would learn this is not how we act when we are doing them around people. Thank you.
Yeah.
But Jesus. He does, as ordered, follow her into her office, which has a door. And because it's a soap, as soon as he has come in, she slams the door behind him, drops the stack of papers in her hand, and starts furiously making out with him. And, like, I don't not get it, I guess. But, you know, don't reward this behavior if you don't want more of it.
Yeah.
Like, think it through.
Yeah.
But I guess it's also, like, it speaks to her status in the office that she's not really worried about this being the talk of, you know, the bullpen for the rest of the year.
Like, yeah.
This is quite the scene.
She also seems pretty confident that she can handle him, so okay, I guess.
True. So Joe, carrying a chintzy little trophy, finds Reed's numbered stone in the pauper's field and kneels next to it. And then Reed's stupid ghost appears behind her. And please go to the visual aids, because Daphne Zuniga makes an accidentally hilarious face when he says that she should have been there for the funeral, because he's like behind her. And she's like, the face is like, what? Wait, what? It's like, I can't really describe it, but it's very funny. And I don't think intentional. But anyway, he monologues on for a while in clip 9.
Two cemetery guys in a hurry to get home. That's why I'm only 4 feet under instead of 6, which is law, I think. You have to be at least 6 feet under. Me, talking about the law. There's a good one. Co-captain. I was an elected position, by the way, voted on by my teammates. It's the one place I was popular in high school, the cross-country team. Perfect sport for me, don't you think? Get out in front and then say, come and catch me, if you can, like I did with the cops. And you, and everyone else. You're thinking if you don't look at me, I'll go away.
Something like that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I know why you dug up that trophy, too. It's for the kid, isn't it? That's good. I mean, I approve. That way he'll know who I am. But don't sugarcoat it, though, okay? Make it a lesson, in case there's anything to that genetic thing.
You're impossible. Even dead, you're impossible.
Yeah. Well... admit it, though. In high school, I was cool.
Yeah, you're pretty cool.
Well, you can tell that to that kid, too, okay? That being cool in high school can lead to being a criminal later. And by the way, not that it matters. I was a dreamer, not a criminal. There's a subtle difference.
Not really. You were both. Also, shut up.
Yeah, like, this is, he's not real. Like, she's just conjuring all of this. This is so dumb. Anyway, finally, she's.
Yeah, guess they were running short.
No doubt. So he says he knows why she's there. She wants him to forgive her she wants him to forgive her for killing her. But he never gave her a choice. He sucked her in. He let her fall in love, lying to her all the while. And he fell in love with her, too, which I guess, again, as we were complaining about in the last episode, that's the piece that's supposed to make us think that her going, carrying the pregnancy is okay, is, you know, which, yeah. Like, again, any decision that you make when you're pregnant is fine. But, like, in the context of the show is kind of bullshit. But so crying,
yeah.
She says she forgives Reed, and then... apparently, he blows away. So, okay. God.
And then someone lights some sage on the next set over, and bye, Reed. Jesus.
Finally, our A-plot. Michael and Sydney's honeymoon takes an unexpected turn. Matt and his marginally better hair, which you can see in the visual aids, are on the phone trying to track down Michael in Northern California. This is also where I suddenly notice there's a music stand in the corner of his apartment and a trumpet on the shelf.
Yeah. Like, I've noticed that before, and then it always just sort of falls out of my brain.
Yeah. Matt is like,
he likes to blow.
Oh, Sarah.
Sorry.
Sarah.
I'm not sorry at all.
No, you're not. So Jane and her bangs pop by with some mail of Michael's she would like Matt to give to Michael at the hospital. He starts to tell her it'll have to wait and why, but then he stops himself because Jane doesn't want to know all the gory details, and she serenely assures him it doesn't matter. Clip 10.
I just figured all these reminders, you know.
No, I could care less. Sydney and Michael may be married now, but you watch. Give it enough time, those two will kill each other.
Ooh.
I don't get it.
Yeah. So cut to the adorable little stone cabin up north where Sydney's in the yard picking flowers. She brings them in, sticks them in the face of a sleeping Michael who is not interested and also has allergies. She loves the cabin and how remote it is and thinks the honeymoon will be a great opportunity for them to get their marriage off on the right foot. She's going to make him breakfast in bed because that went so well the last time. And as she bustles off, he gets out of bed and retrieves from his bag a bottle of some kind of poison that is straight out of, like, Acme Industries from a Roadrunner cartoon.
It really is. Like,
it just says poison, do not eat or something. Like, it's in the visual aids.
There's, like, a skull and crossbones, and it's like, do not consume. Like, there's no other labeling on it. Like, well, then what is it for?
Right.
Just not consuming?
Yeah.
Anyway.
There's more information on, like, the desiccants in your shoes when you buy them. Like,
there seriously is.
Which, like, just use that. That's something that people already have. Anyway, not that I'm advising you. Don't do that. I don't know anything about murder. Cough. Hey, it's that Tracy Walter, who is the manager at this resort, picks up the phone at the desk of the Dreamy Pines facility. And it's Matt, still trying to track down Michael. And he has... Tracy Walter thinks that Dr. and Mrs. Mancini are on a hike at the moment. Matt declines to leave a message saying he's trying to see how things are going, as though that is not an extremely weird thing to ask of the front desk guy at a cabin resort where newlyweds are honeymooning, which is basically what the guy says. And Matt's colleague, Angela, comes in and Matt starts fake coughing and claims he needs to take a sick day, maybe two, and she will cover for him. Cut to said hike. Michael finds Sydney skinny dipping in a murky looking hot spring. He won't swim anywhere. He can't see the bottom. Then she calls him a chicken. He seems to get an idea. She playfully dunks him and he does it back and then holds her down. But then another couple rolls by hiking and he obviously cannot murder her in front of witnesses. So he lets her back up. And she asks how long it's been since she said she loves him. And he crabs that she hasn't stopped since they got there. She counters that he hasn't said it since she made him. Once he didn't know she was keeping score. She knows he'll say it again. She has faith, and she kisses him and sinks away. And that night, Michael dumps so much poison in Sydney's snifter. It's like easily a teaspoon of poison. Like, I don't know how much you're supposed to use, because as I said before, I don't know about murdering people, but it seems like too much. Given the size of the bottle.
Well, if that small a bottle, it, like, the only thing it says on the bottle is no.
Right. Yes.
Probably you just need a couple drops. But again, I also do not know about murdering people.
Yeah. So it seems like a large amount. And then he, you know, puts in some brandy and swirls it around. And so she's in the kitchen cooking a fish and bitching that the place hardly has any spices. And he is, like, bug-eyed waiting for her to take her glass from him. So they toast to their lives together, and as Sydney takes a sniff, she realizes that that's what's missing from the fish, and she tosses the contents of her glass into the pan, and it flames up, and Michael, of course, flips out and douses it with water, even as she tries to tell him it's a flambé, and dinner is ruined. He says they can go out, and then seethes in the hall, and while she curiously sniffs her empty glass. The next morning, the phone rings in the cabin. It's Matt calling from a payphone near the airport. He will be there by nightfall. They need to talk before Michael does anything. And Michael yells that it's a bad connection and hangs up. And then Sydney comes out of the shower and Michael announces that they're going camping. And Sydney does a, I would say, C-minus job of acting like she does not hate this idea. But That night, beside a campfire, Sydney comments that she and Michael are different from other people. It's why they're together. And he mumbles they're together because of her blackmail. But if you believe in destiny, they were always meant to be together. And that's why it didn't work out for him and Jane or Kimberly. And then she asks if she's ever told him her first sexual fantasy was about him.
Oh, God.
Clip 11.
Creepy.
You and Jane were out necking on the sun porch we had up at the lake. And I was watching from the dock. It was a full moon, so I could see everything. You had your hand on her breast. And I thought I could feel it on mine. I got completely turned on.
I mean,
please get therapy.
That is creepy, especially since, like, based on the timeline and what we know, she was probably like a young teenager, maybe. But that's like some pretty decent softcore erotica for a network show in the early 90s. That's like some Silk Stockings shit,
I guess.
I don't know. I was just surprised. It was like more explicit than I was expecting. I don't know.
I mean, and also Leighton sells it because that's what she does.
She does. And she ends by saying she thinks that deep down, he really loves her. And morosely, Michael asks if she thinks someone like him knows what love is. And she thinks he's looking too hard and in all the wrong places. And he tells her to go to bed. She asks if they're going to the ridge tomorrow. Apparently, you can see the whole valley from there. And she's like, sounds neat, unconvincingly, and goes, while Michael stares at the fire and says it'll be perfect. The next day, Matt is realizing how crazy his story about Michael and Sydney being missing sounds as the local sheriff or trooper or whatever, who is Sarah.
Hey, it's that Ghostbusters hotel manager, Michael Ensign, who was also in War Games. So I guess there was like a pipeline of War Games actors to this production.
Keep my eyes peeled for Barry Corbin next. So he repeats it back to Matt, like, do you realize what you're telling me? So then Matt just comes out with it and says he thinks that Michael took Sydney to the mountain to kill her. So Michael Ensign will put together some deputies. But if Matt is wrong, it's his ass, basically, and his bill. So Sydney in her very 90s outfit make it to the edge of the ridge. She maybe does and maybe doesn't notice Michael creepily walking up behind her until he's gripped her by the shoulders. But then he lets her go. And she turns around and says, clip 12.
I knew you couldn't do it.
Do what?
I had faith in you. It's not my Michael. He's no murderer.
Sydney, I don't know what you're talking about.
See, Michael, my theory's the right theory.
Theory?
Time heals wounds, even yours, Michael. You walked again, didn't you? And you thought you never would? And you'll love me again someday. Even though it may not seem like it right now. Thank you, Michael.
I mean, here's a little story. A real life story like this one where some, like, kind of fighting couple where the husband was having an affair went on a hike and only the husband came back was on TV the night that I got engaged. And I was like, whatever. It was my birthday. I was drunk, was eating a sandwich, and we're watching Investigation Discovery at 2 a.m, as you do, because we're totally functional people. And I was like, look, we get married. If you're sick of it, just get a divorce. Don't fucking push me in a ravine. And Dan's like, when we get married? And I was like, well, whatever, you know what I mean. And then it turned into a whole thing and I proposed. But it was because some husband was like, nope, and shoved the wife off a cliff. And I was like, look, we get married, can you just not? And he hasn't yet.
I mean,
we don't do a lot of hiking.
No, but considering you've been locked in the house for 6 months, like, that's not nothing.
So, I mean, someone really should be at the bottom of a chasm by now, and it is probably me.
Well, so after the commercial, Matt is bellowing at the sheriff, who has still not been able to locate Michael and Sydney. And if Michael wants to pay for a helicopter, the guy will get one from Truckee. Otherwise, they're doing the best they can, which, frankly, is more than is warranted, given the lack of a credible threat Matt has been able to describe, in my opinion. And then, sure enough, Michael comes around the corner with his backpack, confused about what all the cops are doing there. And seeing him alone, Matt fears the worst and gasps that Michael killed Sydney, which is when Michael figures out the cops are there because Matt called them. And Michael Ensign smugly asks Michael where his wife is. And Michael's like, you mean my current wife? And up smugs. Well, she's a little smug, too. Up stomps Sydney as alive as can be. She assures Michael Ensign that she's fine. And Matt apparently will be getting a bill for this wild goose chase. And as the cops roll out, Sydney coos at Matt that a couple of days in the woods will do him a world of good. And Michael sits on the steps smugly. So Matt gets back to L.A. and heads straight to Jane's without even dropping off his bag at his place to tell her about the blackmail, including his part in it, and also about going to the mountains due to his suspicions about Michael's intention to murder Sydney. He wanted Jane to hear about it from him because he's thinking about confessing because he doesn't see any other way out. And Jane says, clip 13.
Don't, Matt. Don't go to the authorities. You'd be destroying your career.
I don't know what else to do. I have thought and thought about this.
There's another way to handle it, a better way. And the only people that are going to get hurt are them.
Okay. Speaking of out of character, but sure.
Yeah. I don't see her being this smart or quick.
Yeah. Yeah.
Honestly, like, we have not seen evidence of this before, but sure. Also, you'd ruin your career. Like, I think what he did is a crime, actually. Anyway, over to the beach house. Michael comes out of the shower. Sydney starts trying to pull off his towel before wrapping her arms around his neck and saying it's a perfect honeymoon, except for one thing, not enough sex. He should get a condom. She'll go turn down the bed. Jane shows up at the glass door and bursts in with a box, saying she realized she hadn't gotten them a wedding present. Sydney opens it to find a folded piece of paper. Clip 14.
It's a signed confession from Matt, witnessed and signed by me as well. It implicates Michael in the drunk driving murder of Kimberly Shaw. I got plenty of copies, so you can go ahead and tear that up, eat it, do whatever you're planning to do, dispose of it. Why, Jane? What do you want? It's simple, lovebirds. I want you to stay out of my life, both of you, permanently. But more importantly, I want you to stay together. Forever in this sick, loveless marriage. If you separate or divorce, I lower the boom. Well, good luck, you two.
I mean, it is.
Only some of it is her fault, really.
But do you understand exactly what this plan is?
Which plan? Jane's plan?
Jane's plan.
That if either of them ends up dead, that she'll take this to cops? Right?
Okay. But it's like, if they don't end up dead, then they have to stay together or she'll also go to the cops?
They have to stay together and torture each other.
I guess I just don't understand who, like, the, you know, her only leverage is not actually her. It's Matt.
Right.
So,
I mean, I don't know what she thinks, why she thinks it's Matt's signed confession and I also witnessed it. Like, who are you?
Who cares?
Right?
Yeah.
We're both notaries.
What? I guess I don't understand. Like, in addition to being out of character, it kind of doesn't make any sense. And I would just, like, immediately call the bluff, but it's like, whatever.
Yeah. I mean, this was, like, Michael's leverage over Matt this whole time. Like, I don't know why he would not he wouldn't turn around and try to implicate Matt first.
Yeah.
But, well, whatever.
Guess we'll find out.
This is soap logic anyway.
Yeah.
And it's about to be moot in about 1, 2, 3, 4 episodes by my count. Mm-hmm. So, spoiler alert. Let us close things up by naming our episode MVP. Oh, God. This was a rough one.
Yeah. Sydney, I guess.
Yeah.
She managed not to get killed.
She
and
did.
As usual, Laura Layton is killing it.
She is. And she even made her dumb 90s hiking outfit look good. So, on all counts, she did it.
Yeah.
Least valuable player. Allison.
Sometimes dead is better.
True.
Allison is legit, though. Good choice.
Listen, Allison, like, if you're not fucking Billy, what are you keeping him around for? Conversation? Like, honestly, use your head. Use his head.
The other one, yeah. next time and again with this butt stuff. Just kidding. Probably not. Jane inherits a business starter fund from her grandma, but Michael and Sid have D signs on the money. Nice. Joe's pregnant and dating pilot doesn't get picked up, and Allison's father's birthday isn't going to be the only surprise in that plot line. It probably won't surprise you to learn that we did visual aids for this and every other episode of Again With This. You'll find those on our website, againwiththispodcast.com. To learn more, follow us on Twitter at AWT90210 or track us down on the honeymoon that is our Patreon page. That's patreon.com/againwiththis. I'm Cemetery Gale in a Hurry, Sarah D. Bunting, and I'm on Twitter at Tomato Nation. My co-host is Romantic Sex Strike, Tara Ariano, and she's on Twitter at Tara Ariano. And our producer is Signed Confession, David Deagle. Talk to you next time.
This isn't supposed to be miserable.
And yet...